Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Thank you very much, Howard. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, occupying the coveted corner booth. I'm Patrick Evans. We are ready for another exciting episode. This is a big episode.
Huge.
Kicks off season 9. This is the 131st episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar.
I'm sick of hearing my own voice.
Well, that makes two of us. Okay, so those, like, did you ever think when you thought about doing this podcast that we would go 130-plus episodes?
Well, no, because you remember my initial idea was so ridiculous, it would have only lasted like 3 episodes.
And they would have been 5 minutes long.
5 minutes long.
What's your favorite song? It's the Beatles. Okay,
thank you.
Thank
and
you.
And next week.
That wraps it up. I want to jump right to our guest because I'm so excited about this, and I have to first apologize to her because I have basically kind of stalked her on Instagram for a while.
Has she seen your wrist?
No, she hasn't. I haven't showed her. No, okay. She doesn't know that I'm a... We'll get into it. We'll get into it.
Nothing to be afraid of.
Stephanie Chkowski is an actress, a voice actress, a performer. You've written a short film that you want to direct. Live part-time here in the Coachella Valley.
I do.
And you and your husband are still very active in the L.A. scene, and he is a screenwriter as well.
Yes, yes.
Well, we're so delighted
Welcome.
To have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's not really us talking. I just feel bad because I was like, you reached out. And I was said, yes, of course. And then tumbleweed silence. So my apologies. Thank you for your patience.
We're just delighted that you're here.
We just figured that meant you had actually checked out the podcast. So
She saw me do the weather. She was like, I'm not going to talk to this.
I know. I was like, oh, interesting.
It was on a day it was really hot. And she was pissed.
You have been involved since you moved here. We have a mutual friend, Melissa Niederman.
Yeah,
who's been
a
guest. And you did the lip sync.
And event. I won.
Yeah.
And I won.
Wow. What did you perform?
I performed because my hair is, I dye my hair kind of platinum now. It's a little spiky. I performed Never Not Gonna Dance Again by Pink.
Ooh.
And I did. I won.
Well, congratulations.
Bravo.
And I was very proud of myself.
You're probably able to retire off of that, huh?
I'm not sure that I can sell that little microphone that looks...
Oh.
That in if you don't see a light on it, looks is somewhat phallic looking. But I was happy to do it.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
That's phenomenal. And I just love that you got involved. I know that you're only here part time, but you got involved in the community in that way, which is very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we will jump right to the heart of it.
You have been bubbling with excitement for a few weeks.
Oh,
now.
Yeah. There we go.
Patrick
has just taken off an article of clothing.
Yeah.
No, I did not.
He moved to watch.
I moved
to
watch.
Are you listening? Otherwise, it would be like, lady, why did you walk in here? What is happening?
Or she went, oh, that's nice.
So you had a terrific role. You got to play a Vulcan on Star Trek Picard.
Yes, I did.
Of the newer iterations of Trek, that one is, I think, probably the best received. People love it, that and maybe Strange New Worlds. But that third season of Picard was just so acclaimed.
Yeah.
So I was so excited to have you on. There have been a number of guests that are tangentially or related to Star Trek. We've had folks who've written episodes and people who've appeared. But it's just so exciting to me because I loved that whole season. It was nostalgic and it was great. And then I'm not going to give it away because you're probably not going to watch it anyway.
I'm going to watch it.
Her character dies tragically, and it's quite a surprise.
I don't need to. Thank you.
What was it like?
To die?
No, no. I'm
like, well, I don't recommend it. No. It is. It's hard, really, as I pause, because it was so. It's such a responsibility to step into and be a part of a franchise that is so beloved. My father was a huge Trek fan. He had passed away a couple of years before I actually booked this, and so I wasn't as much of a Trek fan as he was. But it was funny to. Book the job, because you're like, yeah, I booked the job, and they don't tell you what it is, and we didn't even know it was going to be a Vulcan. It was, you know, dummy sides, but it was a science officer, and I was like, well, it sounds very Vulcan-y, so I guess I'm just going Vulcan. And then when I booked the job and got to set, the showrunner, Terry Metalis, was like, well, of course it's a Vulcan. And then there was conversation about, I tried the wigs on, I looked terrible, so we decided that we were going to shave my head, because it had already been shaved. And then we also said, I am 3/4, it's important to note, 3/4 Vulcan, 1/4 Delta, hence the bald head. Anyway.
Oh, I was unaware of that.
Yes. But it's surreal to walk on that bridge and look around and recognize that you've seen this on screens and television, and now you're here. And then you look over and you see Jonathan Frakes and Patrick Stewart, and you're like, oh my God. And then you have to stuff it all down because you also have to do the work, right? So it is unequivocally the most rewarding experience I've had that is sustained since being, you know, being able to be a part of specifically that season, because when I started reading the scripts and I got chills when I read the first episode that said the next generation, and I still get chills because I was like, oh God, they're going to try and spin this off. Just stay alive. And we know how that happened, what happened with that. But I started realizing as I was looking at the call sheet that all of these, I just started calling them the OGs. All the OGs were coming back, and we were going to be part. I was going to be witness to this reunion that was so long in the making, or so, you know, people had been waiting for so long. So doing that was just in and of itself. I'm just so lucky, you know, just as somebody who got to be there. And then also, be a character that, I mean, it's, you know, I do a little bit. I'm not a background character, but also as somebody who was a very small supporting character, the ingratiating of both everybody like Gates McFadden and all of the Star Trek peeps, as well as the fandom, is unlike anything I have experienced thus far in my career. And so that in of itself, just doing it, and then having to be quiet about it for 2 years because we shot it in the end of 2021. It was done in 2022, and then we had to wait a year, and then it came out in 2023, so you couldn't talk about it. And then, so you've done that, you've experienced it, you've got to bond with all these people, many of whom are fans themselves. And I think that's the most interesting thing about being on set, is so many of the people who work on Trek shows legitimately love this franchise. And that's just, you don't get that when you're working on other shows. And then to go to the premiere and then realize that it has this whole other life of its own.
There's generations of people.
Because I'd been warned, but yeah. I didn't realize I'd walk and there'd be fans like, wah! And I didn't realize that I would go to conventions and people would, you know, kind of geek out over me. But also I've come to know these fans and have made friends with these fans and have, you know, gone to these conventions, and it's, you know, afforded me the ability to go to aerospace conventions. Like, the people that I meet who are Trek fans are so much smarter than I am. Like, I'm just like, they'll be like, oh my God. And I'm like, oh, no. You are legit changing the world. Like, you are legit taking that idea that Roddenberry originally intended for this franchise and really living it. Yeah. So that is a very long-winded thing to say.
Tell us a little bit about the process leading up to it? How did you get the part?
I wish it were like, oh my God, this happened. I had just...
I was at a counter at Walgreens.
Yeah, no. I was sipping a soda. And no, it was an audition from my agent. I had just gotten back from, I was in a show called MacGruber for Peacock. And I just literally, I'd been back for like 2 days. I had booked this job and I had this kind of short hair because I was playing Billy Zane's like right-hand hench person. Yeah. And I got back and there was a breakdown and they said like, female 40 to, it was just this random like female 40 to whatever science officer, I don't even remember what the name was, and it was a self-tape, and my agents had submitted, I have a bald headshot because in 2018 I had gone through breast cancer and I had lost my hair because of chemotherapy, and when I knew it was going to fall out, I was like, am I allowed to swear on here?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, fuck it. So.
Oh, you can't say that though.
Oh,
no,
sorry.
No, you can totally say it.
So, frack it. So I will just cross pollinate. So we shaved my head and I shaved my head and went got headshots. Cause I was like, I don't know. I'm like, I called my agent when I was diagnosed to be like, I can now do all the breast cancer, like, because they always ask for like real breast cancer survivor, and like, put me in, coach, put me in for commercials. And so I had this headshot and it had booked me another job on a pretty, if you're a DC fan, a pretty like a cool DC show that ran for a couple years.
Which one was that?
Doom Patrol. On HBO Max. Yeah. And I'd booked it while I was in the middle of chemo and my hair was bald and it was called Hammerhead, but it was, I would have been called anyway because of my stature, but the head nailed, like the head, they were like, please don't grow your hair back. And I was like, I cannot grow my hair back. But then I kept going on that show and I kept shaving. So my agents at Leisure are totally comfortable with the fact that I will shave my head at the drop of the hat. Anyone out there, I will shave my head.
If you're looking for a bald character,
please know that I'm willing to shave head. So
eager, as a matter of fact.
Yes, eager. Oh my God. So basically I got this head, I got this audition and they'd used my bald headshot and I had a little bit of hair and I was like, I think I need to shave for it. So I shaved what hair I had off. We did a self tape. It came in on Wednesday morning. They were like rolling pretty fast. So it came in on a Wednesday morning. We did it on a Thursday afternoon, I think. It was in by Thursday afternoon. And by Friday, they were like, you're pinned, which meant that they wanted me, but they had generally means they want you, but they have to clear it all the way up the thing. So I basically knew, I think by Friday, like it was a 2 day, like done, here we go. And it was just, here we go. So.
And you knew what it was at that point?
I had an idea. They always put out when they're doing, you know, top secret stuff that they're afraid people are going to share. They always have a code name, and I can't remember what the code name for it was, but there was a code name. But if you pay attention to our industry, which is my job, you start to know who casting is, who, you know, who's casting what directors, if you're following directors, what they're working on. And when you see those names, it's not hard to figure it out.
You can connect all those dots.
Yeah, you connect the dots. And I mean, also one of the things that I do is, they'll tell you who the showrunner is and who the director is. And so I'll just do the due diligence of finding out what they've worked on, or if it's a new show, you know, what the tone usually is. So you have a sense of how you're trying to fit into that puzzle. And so it was a pretty quick turnaround. It was just self-tape done and there we go.
Wow.
And
then you've got kind of a scientific approach to figuring all of this out.
Yeah. I think we have so little control of this industry. We have control over certain things. We have control over, you know, doing our work to make sure that we are creating a character that is is real for the thing that we're doing. But also, you know, you also have to know the tone of something, because everything has its own, can have its own, tonally can be different, right? And you're not always going to fit in, and sometimes that's hard to remember as an actor. So you, I try to know as much as I can going in, because the more information I have helps me make the choices I make, you know?
So how does it, how does a little girl from Wisconsin end up on the bridge on Star Trek?
You know, sometimes I have to remind myself that that is kind of how far I've come. Like, because you start to do stuff and you're like, it's, I got to do the next thing. Nothing's, and then you're like, whoa, wait a minute. So I always wanted to be a performer. I mean, and a lot of people say that. I am not alone in that.
There's a great story on your bio where you said you saw an episode of the Brady Bunch.
Oh. Yes.
And you told your mom that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
Brady Bunch had been in syndication for 10 years.
Yes, yes. It had been in syndication a long time. I would come home.
So your career ended right there.
I know. So I came home from kindergarten, and it used to be on with... It was in syndication in Wisconsin, so then also things are like older, because I mean, I used to watch Trek and Hogan's Heroes with my dad, right? So I mean, Wisconsin at the time, I mean, it was a little bit behind everybody else. So I was watching the Brady Bunch and I think the Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Like
right after each other.
Bill Bixby.
Yeah. Incredible Hulk. So there was something about when Cousin Oliver came on that I realized there could be a space for me too, because I didn't fit in the family. But I might be able to be part of it. And so I insisted my mother write a letter to the local ABC affiliate to tell them I wanted to be on the show. And they actually wrote back. And they said, well, the show hasn't been on for decades.
So we don't have to pay her much. Right,
but you should get in. You should start getting into like acting and modeling, children's modeling. And so it was something I always wanted to do. My mother was not somebody who... My dad was a mechanical engineer. My mom was a stay-at-home mom who was also a seamstress and dressmaker.
My dad was a mechanical engineer, too.
Yeah. So it's not like we had the, you know, in on how to do it.
She wasn't driving you around the country
for auditions. No, and also, we also just didn't know how you did it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started writing plays. I went to a Catholic school. I started writing plays so that instead of writing reports, like I had to do a report on Louis Pasteur, and so I read a play so we could do it in class. Like any excuse that I could, like, kind of, you know, create a show or whatever, I did. And then we moved when I was in sixth grade. We moved to the suburbs of Chicago, and the suburbs of Chicago actually had Naperville, Illinois, had summer theater. So I auditioned for summer theater, and I went from Catholic school to public school, and so public school actually had these musicals they did. And then when I got to high school, we had a really robust theater program. We did two main stage shows, a Christmas show directed by students, one act directed by students, and a musical. So it literally, once I got into high school, it was show.
Your parents supportive of all of this?
Yeah. I mean, in high school, sure. Yeah. You know, the idea that I'm going to go off and do it. Yeah. My dad, until he died, was like, you work at that gym. Could you become a manager?
And you still teach classes at gym.
Oh, yeah. No, I still, it's a great second, like, because the thing about the industry, and I think that's the thing that my father was so scared of, is that it's just not a 9-to-5. It's not a job that you get in and that's what you do. And it's also not... doesn't have any rhyme or reason to it, right? It's
he had a different side of his brain than you were using.
Yeah, I mean, and I have that side of my brain, which I think sometimes stops me. My mother had the other side because they eventually got divorced, and she was like 1099 doing all this stuff, like making it work. So I had an example of how to do it. But my aunt, who lived in Chicago, her daughter went to this very hoity-toity private school, and she was friends with this woman named Sue Wexler, who was Daryl Hannah and Paige Hannah's mom. And so there was a bunch of performers who went to that school. And so I met Sue Wexler and asked her, like, how do I do this? And she was like, well, if you're going to college, you should go to NYU, Yale, or Northwestern. So that's what I did. I applied there, not knowing that they were actually talking about the grad program, but whatever. And it was a different thing. But when I turned 7, you know, I applied to School of the Arts. I went to Chicago on the on Valentine's Day to go audition, and I auditioned for them. And the guy who actually passed away later that year from HIV or from AIDS in the room was like, "All right, well, we'll see you in September." And I was like, "Okay." It was like done deal. I'm like, "This is what I do, and they'll tell me how to do it." And so, you know, I went to NYU. I graduated semi early. And then I had to figure out how to make it in the business, because they're doing a better job now, I think, to teach people how to navigate it and get into it and actually work in it. But it was trial and error, man. Yeah. Like I spent a lot of years bartending. I spent a lot of years doing off Broadway theater. I took a couple of summers where I'm like, do I really want to do this? Because it seems to me I could probably make a money. When I was working at a bar, there was a guy who was like, "I want to open a bar. I want you to run it." And I was like, ugh.
So when was the point when you went, I can sustain myself doing this for a living?
I never assumed that I would.
No.
I never assumed that I would. My goal was always in my mind, because my dad was a mechanical engineer, I was like, if I can pay my rent, pay my bills, and I have health insurance somehow, then I will be fine. Yeah. And so I did that through various other things. I was a bartender. I became a fitness instructor and then a personal trainer. And so I just kept doing it. And I just kept showing up, because I knew that when there were, like, early on, there were a couple of times where I'm like, I just need to take a break and not try and do this. And I knew that my life felt incomplete without it.
Yeah.
And so that was the thing. I was like, if I can be fine not doing it, let's do it. Let's go make money, bitch. But I couldn't. Like, I was not happy in it.
It was the thing that you wanted to do.
Yeah, it was the thing. And so there was, you know, and so it, I started, you know, I moved out here. And it was, my first job on television wasn't until I was in my mid-30s. And because I was doing film, I was doing television. And also because then you learn, like, oh, you're 5'10" and you're this, and you're, so you have to figure out where you fit in. And so I was a cop, and I was, thank God for Shonda Rhimes. I was a cop, and I was a firefighter, and I was getting bigger roles in different things. It was my big break came hand in hand with cancer. And I think part of it was I gave less fucks.
Yeah.
Because I had this bald head. I was going in for these things that I probably would have gone in for. I would have gone in for anyway. But they were less precious because I had something else that I had to worry about.
Right.
And so I think what it did is, I think part of coming from where I come from, especially when I've been around people who, like, I did a thing at Steppenwolf, and Bryce Dallas Howard was there. She was in my class, and she was like 19, so this was like 20 years ago. We were all like little kids. But I recognize when I see in my colleagues or in my friends who are having kids, the difference of growing up in and around this industry.
Yeah.
And the difference that you have, kind of, because I think that if you're coming from a place of consuming and loving, there is something that's like, that you're like, oh, it's art and I have to do it right. And you get a little in your head over like, you want to be right so you can do the thing and do the things, as opposed to just being like, recognizing that it is a job as well. And I found that I started, for me, and this is just me, when I was like, oh, I have to get a job. When it was a job, it was less precious to me.
Yeah.
And I'm good at getting jobs because I've gotten jobs my entire life, right? So if I changed the point of view on it, it made it easier to drop down and be creative and bring my full self to it than thinking I was trying to do something that was right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I just look really good with a bald head, man. I mean, I just do. And then also, like,
you do. You look fantastic with a bald head.
But I mean, but it also is that thing. It is true that, like, what's ever yours will come to you. So this just happened to be like, Doom Patrol happened. And then right after Doom Patrol, you know, MacGruber happened. Like, there was a year that was like Doom Patrol into MacGruber into Picard. Like that is the busiest I've been consistently because I was in multiple episodes in my entire career. And, you know, and so I was like, whoa, this is amazing. But I also, you know, but it also doesn't happen like that. Like, we as performers, even as big as people are, like, some people will be like, turn to the next thing. But you also, if you are in things that other people are creating, either there has to be something that you can fit into. And at that point in time, especially with streaming being what it is, I was just really fortunate. I was very fortunate that there were things that I fit what they were looking
you
for.
You had and the look. You had the.
I had the look. I had the ability, and yeah. I had, you know, I had the talent. And the chops to do it, because, you know, that's the thing about, you know, Doom Patrol in particular is it could have been a look, but then they started writing a little bit more for my character in a way that was really lovely, you know, and that. But it's all, you know, it all it because. What you look like tells a story.
Yeah.
So, and that was how it was fitting in. So.
Did you ever get to the point of giving them notes about your character?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I will say, however, when I was working on Picard, when we were deciding, you know, about Tavine's hair and whatever, you know, Terry Metalis was like, came down and was like, so what do you think what we should do? And so I went out and he was like, well, decide on it. Let's talk about it. And so I was the one who was like, what happens if we make her Dalton? Excuse me. Because if you know Star Trek fans, you know that they know canon very well. So if we were going to indeed have this bald Vulcan who wasn't super old, and we're going to decide she's a part Dalton, we needed to make sure our ass was covered. You know, we needed to be like, all right, if this is going to happen... And he was like, all right. I mean, and it doesn't come up.
Because you're going to walk into one of those Comic-Cons and somebody's going to call you on something.
Well, and the thing about it is it doesn't come up in what I do on the show at all. Okay? But for me as an actor, being like having that, it gives a duality that Spock has. It gives a like Dalton and Vulcan are very different. And so it gives a duality of...
Daltons are such a sensual race.
Yeah.
That they actually have to take an oath of celibacy to serve aboard starships.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, Vulcans are completely logical and non-emotional. So that's a really interesting combination. That'd be a great something. And it's a great callback for fans, because the first time a Dalton showed up was in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Exactly, which is the first movie I saw in the movie theater.
No way!
Seriously?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, so the answer right about is like, when did I know that I could make... I still don't know. Yeah. But what I know is I'm doing pretty good. And I would, you know, and it's been a while since I've worked and I miss it. But also the industry's changing and... Things just keep changing, and if the one thing I've learned from cancer is the one consistent is change. So as long as you're okay with it, you got to be able to pivot.
Okay, we're going to pause for a moment, and we'll be right back after this important message from our friends at the McAllen Theater, the sponsors of our next segment of Big Conversations, Little Bar.
From Grammy-winning songwriters Brandi Clark and Shane McAnally, Tony-winning writer Robert Horn, and Tony-winning director Jack O'Brien comes a musical about corn.
Corn! I'm talking corn!
Shucked! The Broadway musical comedy is about an unlikely hero, a lovable con man, and an amazing battle for the heart and soil of Cobb County. Shucked! Play in McAllen Theater, November 25th through 30th. Tickets at McAllenTheater.org.
Welcome back to Skip Page's Little Bar. The segment is presented by the McCallum Theater. Lots of great performances this season, and we encourage you to check them out by visiting McCallumTheater.org today. I want to circle back to the cancer, because you mentioned that sort of your big break came along at the same time that your cancer diagnosis came along.
Yeah.
And you've had multiple battles with cancer.
Yes, I apparently am a tumor farm. I have had three... different primary cancers. I've had thyroid cancer, breast cancer, and kidney cancer. Luckily, we caught the kidneys super, super early. And that was because the thyroid and the breast were kind of right on top of each other. We found the breast cancer literally the week before I was supposed to go in to have my thyroid removed. And so, yeah, so it and so I found a lump while I was putting myself on tape for an audition.
Wow.
And when I found it, I was like, honey. And he was like, oh, and I was like, no. And it was weird. Cause I just kind of knew, cause he was, you know, cause the first thing you do is, which you should never do, is Google. I tell everyone, like, don't Google it. What did we do?
WebMD.
WebMD. But I had, so we went in, but I also was really lucky because my doctors, my team, or at least I think of them as my team, and I guess I have interacted with them in such a way that they listen to me. So I had just had my thyroid removed. I was going in for my 2-week follow-up after the surgery. And the same morning, I was teaching a fitness class where I was just telling people to run fast on a treadmill. And the My Chart alert came up and I couldn't get on it. So I had to call my husband and ask him, because I'd had a biopsy earlier in the week. The biopsy came back pretty fast. So I had to ask my husband to tell me what the results of the biopsy was when I was driving home.
Oh my gosh.
And he was like, and you know, I lost my mother in 2009 to a very, very rare blood cancer that she was first diagnosed with in 2003. And then it was in remission for 7 years, and then it came back, and then she passed away. And I was pretty involved, not in her daily care, but in the conversations with the doctors. Because at the time, like when she was diagnosed, I came in and you could be treated in like 3 places. And there was all these clinical trials. So I went online and I read them all as best I could. And I went into Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is where we were lucky to get it. We were able to get her treated because it was one of the places. And I asked the doctor all these questions and he literally was like, what do you do for a living? And I'm like, he's like, what do you do? I'm like, I'm a bartender and an actor, but I also can read and I think I know science. I don't know. So I became that person for her and my stepfather.
So you're a very good advocate for
I'm a very good patient. Advocate, right. But what I have
learned... Did that help you get through it, that you were focused on that?
It did, but also what I realized is when they told me I had thyroid cancer, I was like, yeah, whatever. It's a baby cancer, whatever. And then we went to see the surgeon before this happened. And she was like, oh, yeah, you have to have your thyroid removed. It spread to a lymph node, and you have Hashimoto's. And I was like, wait, what? And she was like, so we're going to have it removed. And I was like, no. And they were like, what? My husband's standing there. He's like, what? Because the idea of having my throat cut open was so violent to me and so terrifying. So they ended up testing another thing. I'm like, we'll do this test. If it comes back, we'll do this. But what I realized is you need, as good as I am in that way, my husband is also cut of that same cloth. And he is that person for me, because I don't think you can be that as strong as you are or whatever. It's really hard for you to be that person for yourself. So when we went in, I was good to be like, all right, we need to get the ball rolling of, you know, see my primary care, have a referral, blah, blah. But what happened was for me is we went in to see the surgeon, and because it was all in UCLA, she saw my results because it's all in my chart and she's privy to it. I walked in and she was like, what the fuck? And I was like, I don't know. And so in a very weird turn of events that felt like Grey's Anatomy, we had already moved that appointment early and I had an appointment with my primary care at like 3:00. So it was like 11 o'clock in the morning. And she said, well, you know, I share office hours, totally coincidentally, with the senior surgeon of the Revlin Breast Cancer Center. And if you can hang out, we might be able to fit you in to see her. And I was like, it's not like I'm doing anything else today. So we stayed and then we were waiting. And then we like went down to the cafeteria and then we're there. We get the call. We come back upstairs and Dr. Chang, who was my surgeon, looked at, you know, the thing, looked at the biopsies and the mammograms, because they biopsy you and they squish you. I don't recommend it. It's really not comfortable. And she was just like, I had a 4 centimeter lump in my right breast.
Wow.
Right underneath my nipple. And I shared on social media.
No, you're very open.
I had the most common breast cancers are ductal and lobular. And the difference in how they present is that ductal is in circles. So when you squish it in a mammogram, it looks like a circle, like a bigger circle. But lobular is harder to detect because when you squish it, it's in lines. So I had had a clean mammogram 6 months before that. And when they did the other mammogram after the biopsy, because they did an ultrasound or whatever after I found the lump, she showed me and compared the two. And she's like, yeah, they're really hard to see. Because if you look at them side by side, you can barely tell. And then when I went later and had an MRI, you're just like, oh, Jesus, because it's giant. Mm. So she was like, look, you know, it's... She's like, you have a young... She had a little bit of an accent. And it seems like very wise, too, because she's an older Asian woman. And she was like, you have a old woman's cancer in a young woman's body. Like, great. I don't know what that means.
That's right.
But apparently
Thank you for giving me a title.
I was like, is that good or bad? But she was like, well, we should, you know, I'm suggesting we should do removal because it's so big. We should do a mastectomy with reconstruction. And I was like, okay. She's like, so I'm going to want you to see, you know, the plastic surgeon. I said, great. And so she left and she's like, and you're going to have to get these blood tests. I'm like, great. So she left and we had scheduled some stuff and we're going to try to figure out when we're going to have surgery. And I'm sitting there waiting, thinking I'm going to like get some blood tests. And then suddenly out of nowhere, the head of plastics walks in. So literally it's like, see her head of plastics is there like poking me and just being like, not enough fat. And I was like, oh, well, thank you. It's like, yeah, we can't make another breast out of your fat. You don't have enough. I was like, all right. And he was like, so, you know, he's like, well, we can take one, but, you know, the chances of reoccurrence are 30%, which at the time I thought it was my cancer, but it's the thing they never tell ladies because they drill down on the fact that like 1 out of 8 women in America will get breast cancer or have to deal with breast cancer. But they forget to tell you that 30% of us will have a recurrence or metastatic breast cancer. And I feel like that's really important.
It's a big number.
It's huge. It's a huge number. And so he was like, well, it'll come back, you know, 30% will come back. And so to him, I was just like, he's like, so what do you think? And I was like, well, what'll look better? I was like, can you remake? And he's like, honestly, I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, it'll look better if you do both. I'm like, great, take both of them. Because also I was not particularly attacked that, but then, you know, 6 weeks later, I thought it would be so fast that like the next thing I know, I'd be like in the hospital, but it was, you know, 6 weeks later and I did the double mastectomy and then after the fact, they talked about radiation and chemo and I ended up doing both. And they primarily did it because it was stage 2. It was right in my lymph nodes because they stage it based on how far it's traveled and they didn't see it. It was kind of like stage 2.5 where I was like in my lymph node, but it hadn't gone further that they thought. And they're also like, you're young and you know, you're young and healthy. Let's firebomb you. So they did. But along with that, because the two cancers were so close together, my radiation oncologist is like, have you had a PET scan to make sure that you don't have any other cancer? And I'm like, no, I have not. And he's like, we should probably get you one. And when they did that, they found a very, very small, like a tiny, tiny little tumor on my right kidney, which ended up being cancer, a very slow growing cancer, but cancer nonetheless. And unfortunately with like kidney and uterine cancer, not uterine, but like bladder cancers and stuff, you don't generally see symptoms from those until it's way too far. So I did thyroidectomy, double mastectomy, 6 rounds of chemo, 25 rounds of radiation, then got done, took a mini break, and then had a guy resect my kidney. I still have both of them, though, which is good. And he made a point of telling me that he was very good and that other people would just be like, throw that kidney in a garbage bag. But he managed to put it all together.
So you took a couple of weeks off.
So I took a couple of weeks off. Yeah, so in the midst of all of that is when I booked, like I just started, I booked all these jobs and it was this, I felt like a little bit like it was, I felt a little bit, it was like the universe being like, we're going to balance this out for you.
Yeah.
You're getting a lot of shitty stuff happening. We're going to try to balance it out. And I was like, all right. But it was very much, the entire thing was just really a lesson and just being really in the moment and really present because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to enjoy what I got here.
But you got a lot of bad news very quickly. It must have been terrifying.
Yes, I think so. I am someone very similar to many people who's very good at compartmentalizing things, I think. The previous year, my father, my uncle, and one of my best friends passed away. So I was coming out of this year of like, what is going on? And I think there was, it set me up in a place that I was just kind of very zen about the fact that, oh, this is what being human is. Like, I can't control it. And to a degree, because I had witnessed my mother's battle with her cancer and the fact that it came back because it was not something that was an easily knowable cancer. Like, my cancers were, you know, cancer is easy, but there was something about it to me that I was like, oh, they actually know how to treat this one because you can get it treated everywhere. Yeah. And that's different than having a rare cancer where they're like, oh, I don't know, man. So there was solace in that because I was like, I never thought it was like, I didn't think that I was going to die from it.
And was there a sense also with cancer? There's always a next appointment.
Oh, God,
there's always something that they're going to tell you what to do. This is how we're going to get you to the next step.
Yeah.
I mean, as opposed to I've had some heart issues at times. It's like that just scares the shit out of me because it could just stop.
Yeah.
You know? But the cancer, I always knew there was another appointment.
Yeah. I think it's that. But it's also in the midst of it. You know, in the midst of it, it was so much. It was such an onslaught.
Yeah.
And it was such... You know, and that's when we bought our house in Palm Springs.
Some people would have been really overwhelmed by that.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for that. I picked a good partner.
Well, and she was part Vulcan.
Yeah, I was part Vulcan.
That does help.
Yeah. I think I picked a good partner. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, I picked right. Like, I married the right person.
How'd you two meet?
Bar, drunk. No, I mean, we met at a bar.
Were you working?
I was applying for a job, actually. I was applying for a job. But I think what it was is that we, you know, he states all the time, it's like running out of a burning building, right? You're not, until they say it's over, you're just, all right, we need to get through it. It's like, how do I get to the end? And everything is about not staying in the moment of what could this mean? We do this thing and then we do this thing. We do all the things. And what ends up happening, and this is also why it's harder, I think, for so many people. And I equate this a lot to death, to like losing someone, is in a lot of ways, if someone passes away, the prep and the funeral and all of that stuff is sad, but it is almost easier because so much is happening than the first day you have to live without them. Oh. And you have to go about your life and recognize that loss. And so I think all the emotions were things that came after the fact. Like, and they came after the fact. We actually ended up doing our own podcast in 2020 because COVID. And it had been, you know, it had been a year since all of the stuff had finished. And we were like, oh, And someone had, and we had blogged all the way through it. Like, that was part of how I got through it is, you know, I was like calling you, do one side in, we called it Chemo Skinny, and I wrote my perspective on it. He kind of wrote his perspective just about what we were going through. And then, you know, people are like, you should be doing a podcast. And I'm like, I'm too raw to want to get on and be like, hey, everybody, what's going on? But we did do it a year later to be like, oh, this is how we felt then. This is how we feel now. This is what we wish we had known, just to kind of look back at it. Because COVID, as awful as it was for so many people, and so many terrible things happened for so many people, like, for us, the ability to slow down was the first time I'd been able to slow down since the diagnosis, because I taught through it and then I worked through it. And so it forced an awareness to really sit in the feelings and be like, oh, well, shit, you know, because you're like, oh, it's not going to come back. And I think part of it was, I'm going to get through this because it's not going to take, like, this isn't taking me out. I have to go through this shit, but it's not taking me out. Like, I, for a million, like, I was like, all right, kidney, you cut out the thing. The thyroid, not a big deal. Breast cancer, it's not far enough. It's not going to get me, as it were. So I think having that perspective and that attitude on it certainly helped. When it came back in July 2022, that is a different story. Because that is a much, I think, harder thing to wrap your brain around than the first time you hear those words. Because, I mean, you hear the words and it is unlike anything else. Everyone's like, shit, you know, you're just like, because you go to whatever you know cancer to be. And that's, and then you tell people and you don't realize that I'm just like monopolizing. I'm sorry. And then you tell somebody, and their reaction is always is predicated on their experience of cancer. It's predicated on if they've had people go through it, if they have people who have passed away from it, if you've had people who have survived it. And what you don't realize as someone who's open about it is that now you're taking on a little bit their emotions about it too. Yeah. Which is why I totally get why some people don't say anything. You know?
Well, it must have been particularly shocking because I think you felt like you took great precautions to prevent the repeat instance.
Well, I did all the, I mean, it's the reason I did all the, you know, you do all the things and sometimes all the things aren't enough.
Yeah.
You know, I did all the things. And again, but this was also something that because of being a fitness instructor, it felt like something was wrong. Like it felt like something was off in my body. And I, because of my mother, the one thing I watch my blood tests. I keep an eye on what that stuff does. And I had had a blood test that was elevated, and then a cancer marker that was elevated, and it elevated precipitously in a year. It was still in a normal, close to a normal range. But even when I had cancer, it was never that high. And so when it did that, I talked to my oncologist and I was like, guys, like, should we be checking something here?
Yeah, throwing a flag here.
And so we did a couple more blood tests and it came back elevated again and went up higher and then it dropped down because now I do the cancer marker every month. And it does. It fluctuates, right? And then like 3 weeks later, they were like, we'll check it again in 3 weeks or 3 months rather than 6 months. And I went to see my primary care, who's also very thorough, which I love. And she was like, well, what happened with that? And I was like, well, they tested it. She's like, well, let's do it again. And it went super high. And so we got a bone scan, which is the thing you do because usually breast cancer metastasizes to the bones. And usually, is it bones and brain? No, it's bones and spine. It's like hips and spine usually. And they didn't see anything in the bone scan. And they're like, all right. And I was like, we're doing a PET scan, right? Because also, I also am privileged enough to have union insurance, union health insurance. So I can do that because I'm not like, oh shit, it's going to cost $15,000, because that is also something I'm very aware of. Like, I am alive because of having really, really good insurance through acting, through writers and actors. So it was the PET scan that found the beginning of this very tiny, but we caught it super early, right? So technically I've met a, like I'm managing, and there's a word for it because I've, I forgot the word it is, because it's only metastasized one place. And we literally, it was like a little dandelion coming out. We're like, ah! And so the new drugs are working. And so I'm in a place where my normal, my life, like on Thursday, I go to get my shots. Every month I go to see the oncologist. I take a daily pill. They gave me a shot. They do all the tests. Every 4 to 5 months, I do a PET scan. Like, but I am also able to do that. And that is the thing that's keeping, like, but I also feel good. So it's a, you know, but it's a, it's, it is never ending. There was a show called A Million Little Things that was kind of about breast cancer. And there was a quote from it that said, there is, once diagnosed, there is no life without cancer. Because even after you're done or maybe in remission, there's always the threat of it could happen, you know? So it's, so you just.
How do you cope with that?
I don't think about it that much. And I'm not, I don't actively not think about it. I'm just like, I think I've just, again, I have to, I always compare everything to death, which is sad, but how do you live with someone you love so much who you've lost? Your parents, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And you just learn to hold it, you know? And sometimes you focus on it. Sometimes you focus on it and, you know, it comes like tidal waves. It is not unlike grief. Like it's kind of the same thing. And some days you're just like, you're bowled over. And some days you're like, nope, I'm not. So it's just, it just, you just, I think you just have to accept that. And it makes me mad sometimes too. I'm real fucking pissed off sometimes that I'm just like, come on. And there's nothing worse than having someone be like, well, it's better than the alternative. And I'm like, bitch, sometimes I wonder. Like, I'm like, yes and no, because you have a right to mourn your old life. You have a right to mourn a body that was healthier, that, you know, because you know that it's never going to be exactly the same.
Yeah. Right.
And I think the biggest thing is I just give myself, I've given myself permission to be allowed to feel those things.
Well, I think one of the things about the fact that you are so open with it and your Instagram and your social media, and I mean, you've kind of taken people along with you on that journey.
Yeah.
And I think that probably offers a lot of comfort to people because they see, you know, that you can cope with this and you can still do the things that you do. Has it had a big impact on your career?
I don't know.
Hard to say?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I wasn't leading with it, certainly, when I was first diagnosed, right? And people know about it and it's come up after that, but also all these things came up and then we had a strike and then it's been, so it's like, but there has been things that, you know, when I was shooting, Picard, I booked a day on the, I booked a small guest, a guest star on The Rookie playing a, you know, cancer survivor or cancer, a woman who'd had breast cancer. It's one of kind of one of my favorite little spots. So it's been useful in the sense of using it. I don't know if people don't hire me because of it. I'm not sure. And
that's a, in, you know, like, there's no way to prove it one way or the other.
There's no way to prove it. And I'm also at an age, I think, that I don't give a fuck. That I think that.
Which is also very liberating.
Yeah. I mean, I do kind of care a little bit. But, like, as long as I can do the work. Because, I mean, when I was diagnosed, I reached out to my agents and I was like, okay, so this is what's going on. And my agent was like, look, we're going to keep submitting you, but if you don't feel you can do stuff, just let us know and we'll not submit you and we'll give you the time you need. And I just, it was something that helped me feel normal in something that was so abnormal. So I think the more that I've led with it, especially in, you know, in other years, I mean, cause it's, especially cause, you know, I was much more tentative about being like, oh yeah, so I'm dealing with metastatic breast cancer. Like, it is just part of whatever. And I like being, and I feel that I have a mini platform to normalize it because there's a lot of fucking people who have it. There's a lot of people living in the world with cancer. And there's going to be, as diagnostics and science gets better, there's going to be even more. I mean, because my mom died of that rare blood cancer. And right, she actually died of sepsis. But because she was so weak, like, sepsis isn't great for anyone, by the by. But she was so ill and then got sepsis. And it was just like, and game over. But the drug that she was on, because she had primary amyloidosis, multiple myeloma together with the blood cancer, had actually been working. And when I was sitting down to get my first chemo session, a guy next to me, I heard the name Velcade. It's the name of the drug. I heard Velcade and I was like, because there's nothing worse than nosiest. There's nothing worse. Or was it? There, I said, there's nothing more informative than a nosy bitch. I was just like. So he left and I asked the oncology nurse. I was like, I know this is none of my business, but does he have primary amyloidosis? Like, I heard this thing and they were like, yeah. They were like, yeah, if they catch it early, they treat it like a chronic condition, which blew my mind because when I was reading those, you know, those clinical trials in 2003, the estimated lifespan was 12 to 18 months. That we were supposed to live 12 to 18 months. That was how long people were living. So I think that being open about it is, I don't know. I think it's also why I want to, I mean, this short film, if anyone wants to produce it, and I'm team taking, is about breast cancer a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Know, so this is, you've written this, you want to direct it.
Yes, it's very...
But you did. You submitted this, we talked a little bit about Palm Springs Women in Film and Television, and they solicit scripts to produce films.
Exactly.
You submitted for that.
I did, and I got to, I think I was a finalist. It's, the script itself has been, it's I have to say, I think it's pretty tight. It's a little dark comedy, and it's basically about... a woman returning to work at a healthcare at a in the corporate offices of a gym, not based on life at all, not really based on my life. I mean, kind of, and just
it sounds a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I have taken from life, and basically, it's called I believe it's called Best Intentions, and it's basically just kind of about dealing with the onslaught of good wishes that happen that also feel sometimes overwhelming. And so it's a short at the moment. I have this pipe dream, but because I believe that we can get this done. I would like to, as someone who's now living with it, you know, living with breast cancer, as people do, you know, when you see, my husband and I, he wrote, when we were going through this, because he was going through it too, and he's the one who would have suffered the most, just in case anyone wants to know. He wrote a half-hour single-camera comedy about it. And so we have this, like, limited series called At the Moment Chemo Skinny that's basically about a couple who doesn't have kids, is maybe thinking about having kids, and in the same way you see, like, you know... was a baby boom or whatever, where like suddenly you're thrust with this thing that you have to deal with that changes everybody's life. And the thing about it was really focusing on the relationship, because every movie generally we see about cancer always puts the cancer first and foremost. It's always like the stakes always have to be either someone's living or someone's dying. No one's living with it. And it's usually about... it's usually about the disease as opposed to about the people. And so because there are more people living with it, I'd like to thread that, you know, I'd like to span that thing. Like I would like to see companies instead of, especially media companies or whatever, instead of like, you know, pinkwashing us, I'd like to see them do, you know, programming that is short films from women who, or men, or families who've gone through breast cancer or whatever, or are going through it, but not the part that's all about the breast cancer. Like, I want the part of when you have to go get fitted for the bra and your husband sits down with the little kid and plays with the nipples. Like, I want to talk about that stuff. Because in and of itself, it is awful. But oh my God.
But putting it out there, it takes away some of that.
Yeah,
right?
It's awful. And I mean, that's why we did our podcast, but also so much ridiculous shit happens that's hysterical. Like, I mean, and you also have to have the point of view to look at it. Like, and that was our thing, is like these random things. Like, I'm going in to get my stuff done and I forgot to take off my underwear. So my husband's like taking off the underwear. In walks the doctors.
I went in for my PET scan and forgot to take my watch off.
Oh, God, yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's pounding on my wrist, and I'm hitting the emergency button.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's all this medical stuff that I think that you can thread the story of being human and going through it with, you know, the act, as opposed to it always being about, like, you know, just dying.
Right. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that you're bringing that perspective to it.
Yeah.
I hope that you get this made.
I will. I think I will.
Yeah.
I think I will. But yeah, I think it's...
You mentioned that, like, it's a challenging time in the business, and the business is changing, so...
Yeah, I think... Well, and I also have a very... in that way that I remember, I'm like, fuck it. Like this is a new... You know, this is a new thing for me to do, and I have very specific ideas on how I want to do it and how I want to do it in terms of marketing. So... It's in that I want a budget, like it's because I want to do it and I want to do it well. And in order to do it well, you do need to raise money for it. And yeah. I cannot fund it myself. And right now I'm not comfortable asking a bunch of people for money at the same time because people are struggling, you know. So I think that, you know, and also I think there will be a time and I will figure, you know, I'll figure it out because I'm waiting for a couple things to come in place. So. In the meantime, I just keep sending it out. I'm like, if not, then I'll just, you know, then I'll just get on Cameo and be like, I need to sell some stuff. Who wants to buy my clothes?
You know? You and George Santos.
Exactly. Oh, get on Cameo. My
God. I never thought that would come up.
Stephanie.
How much was he?
Well, the last time it was, no. Go ahead.
This has been absolutely delightful.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me basically sit here and just talk.
That's the whole point,
like,
of it.
Well, I mean, I thought it was supposed to be a conversation, and then I just like was like, I'm just going to stand here and blah, blah, blah. So,
well,
thank you for indulging
that's
me.
That's my favorite kind of conversation. Thank you.
This has been a real treat.
It has. Yeah. And he's been excited about it for a lot of reasons for a long time.
When you did the lip sync thing and Melissa told me that you were living, that's when I reached out. And I was just ecstatic that you answered me back then. I was like, what? No, she said, yeah. So,
God, I'm so sorry.
And the more I read of the story, I just knew I wanted to be sitting next to you talking about this stuff for a while. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Again, I'm like, sometimes I start talking about things that I care a lot about, and then I don't let anyone get in edge or word in edgewise. So,
tried to stay out of the way.
Well, you know.
We look forward to having you back when you get the movie made.
Yeah.
Just thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No, thank you for having
me. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Stephanie.
All right. On behalf of our guest and, of course, on behalf of my co-host, our producer, Mr. McMullen, I'm Patrick Evans. Thanks for enjoying this episode of Big Conversations Little Bar. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode. And our thanks to the team here at Skip Page's Little Bar for always taking such good care of us. And please join us next time for Big Conversations Little Bar.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all in between. Little bar at Big Conversations Little Bar.